much for the introduction. So we are coming to the end of this long and very interesting program, and I decided to organize a rally on 3D gravity because there's a fair amount of people interested in working in the subject. So there will be in three lectures that will be pedagogical lectures. This one is the first one. Jeffrey Comper is going to give the next one. And tomorrow, Stefan de Journay is going to cover the next lecture. And we are going to have four shorter lectures, which are going to be research talks by graduate students, so the youngest experts in the audience, who are going to talk half an hour on 3D gravity. So let me start the paper. So as I said, it's going to be a pedagogical lecture. So I've written the paper. So I've kind of used the papers that I use. The authors are written on the blackboard. I've used it one combination or the other. So my own research work is going to be discussed tomorrow by one of my grad students, Sean Downs, on the supersymmetric version of some of these. So let me start with the motivation. So why 3D gravity? So in three dimensions, gravity has some very particular properties, namely gravity is very much constrained, so that we can hope it's exactly solvable. At the same time, it is interesting enough so that it has got interesting features, such as in particular cases, in case of ADS, in the case when we are in ADS, it has got BTC black holes. So it's interesting enough, maybe it's exactly solvable. And it has got BTC black holes. So in general, so why is gravity so simple in three dimensions? So in general, we can write the Riemann tensor. We can write the Riemann tensor in any arbitrary dimension. The Riemann tensor can be written in terms of the Ricci scalar. I'll write it this way, the Ricci tensor, plus another piece, which is the Weyl tensor, which is conformally invariant, which is conformally invariant and traceless. In three dimensions, this Weyl tensor, so this part here, which is the Weyl tensor, in three dimensions, this Weyl tensor vanishes, so that we can easily write down the Riemann tensor in terms of the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar. So let me just, for concreteness, show you how simple the formula looks like. Right down here. And more terms comes along those lines. So, and what we see, is that any solution to the Balcom Einstein's equations, so any solution R mu equal to zero, is locally equivalent to Minkowski space. Any solution to Einstein's equation with a cosmological constant has constant curvature. So in three dimensions, there are no propagating degrees of freedom. There are no gravitational waves. So that's one motivation why the theory might be very simple. So the theory that I've been discussing, so let me write down the action, is the theory of pure gravity. So I guess I'm coming to my second point, the different models that can be discussed. So different models. So what I've been discussing is the action for pure gravity. Which was discussed in recent times by Witten and Maloney. Well, I wrote it down there already. So, action of pure gravity. Where I'm interested in the case where we do have ADS space, lambda is equal to minus 1 over L squared. L square is the ADS radius, because in this case we do have BTC black holes. And that was the motivation why Witten was interested in this theory. He wanted to understand the black hole entropy in the context of from BTC black holes. So what he wanted to understand is how the quantum theory of pure gravity looks like. So he wanted to interpret this as a quantum theory. He wanted to compute the partition function of the theory. So he used some assumptions. He used the assumption that the partition function factorizes holomorphically, but then ran into trouble when he tried to calculate the partition function explicitly with Maloney. So they found a nonsensical answer, so it's not clear if pure gravity makes sense as a quantum theory. So pure gravity, it's still not clear whether it makes sense. So there came the next approach, which is the approach pioneered by Strominger and collaborators, Lee Sung and Strominger, first paper on the subject. So what they did is they added one more degree of freedom to this theory. They added a gravitational Chern-Simons term. So let me write it in this way. And please interrupt me if there are questions, because we're going to be building one lecture on top of the next one. So they added a gravitational Chern-Simons term, which is a term third order in derivatives. It looks in the following way. So there we do have our gravitational Chern-Simons term added to the action. The good thing about the gravitational Chern-Simons theory is term is, while this theory without the gravitational Chern-Simons term doesn't have any propagating degrees of freedom, it does have boundary gravitons, but there are no degrees of freedom propagating in the bulk. This Chern-Simons term here allows, as we're going to see later on in more detail, for a bulk degree of freedom. Was this our question?
Yes, actually, a question about what Witten did. He assumed that the partition function would take a specific form, that it would be factorizable, and then found that that didn't make sense, it wasn't self-consistent.
Their result then didn't make sense. They couldn't write down, so Maloney wouldn't write down, so okay, we cannot write the partition function as a trace of some quantity e to the minus beta h. So they couldn't write the partition function in the particular form they wanted to have, as we would like to write the partition function. And holomorphic factorization, so one of the problems also of Witten's theory is that holomorphic factorization is not clear at all. But if you wait a second when we discuss, you probably know, where in chiral gravity holomorphic factorization is kind of, you can see it very clearly from the start. We do have the gravitational Chern-Simons term. The gravitational Chern-Simons term allows for a degree of freedom that propagates in the bulk. However, as I wrote the action, this action is what we call TMG. The TMG action was known already in the 1980s. So however, in the way I wrote the action, it turns out that if you evaluate how the energy of this propagating graviton looks like, it's a graviton that has got negative energy, which means that the theory is unstable. So the solution that Desoryakov and Templeton made is they changed the sign of the Einstein-Hilbert term. So they did this in the mid-80s when BTZ black holes were still not known. 10 years later, BTZ black holes were discovered in 1992, I think, and it turns out that if you turn the sign of this Einstein-Hilbert term here, BTZ black holes turn out to have a mass that is negative. In other words, it doesn't make sense to do that either. So there comes the new approach of Strominger and collaborators. So let's put the sign back and see what we do about the sign of the energy. So it turns out that something interesting really comes out when you deal with the sign in the way Strominger and collaborators did. So let me show you this in more detail as I go along. So that's the action for topologically massive gravity, chiral gravity, and log gravity, as I will discuss later on in more detail, are two particular theories that are described by one and the same action, the one I wrote down here, but they do have different boundary conditions. So chiral gravity and log gravity. I've got involve the same action. Later on, we will see that both theories are characterized by, number one, same action, but different boundaries for different boundary conditions for the gravitons at infinity. And both theories have got properties that are very different from each other. While one theory is chiral in the sense that all charges of one sector are equal to zero, the other theory is non-chiral. One is unitary, the other one is non-unitary. So there have been in the literature in recent times discrepancies, people saying, well, chiral gravity is not chiral, it's not unitary, and so on and so forth. But I've been in a conference in Vienna on 3D gravity, and apparently everybody now agrees chiral gravity is chiral and the theory is unitary. So at this point, kind of it looks good. So that's chiral gravity and log gravity. So there's one more degree of complexity we can add, but I won't be discussing so much about this theory, which is the theory that is known as general massive gravity, which was constructed in recent times by Bergshoff, Holm, and Townsend, who added one more degree of freedom to this theory and one more degree of complexity. So they added a term to this action, which is R mu minus 3/8 r squared. So, and that should be a little bit more precise. So there's a constant in front of here. Let me call it m squared. So, and what they allow is for a cosmological constant, which is not only ADS, but they allow one goes with 1 over m squared lambda. So they allow for two types of solutions. They allow for de Sitter and anti-de Sitter solutions. And what they get is TMG is a subsector of general massive gravity. They discuss the different limits of the theory. Limit mu goes to infinity of this theory is what is called new massive gravity that has been discussed in recent times in the literature. So, but as I say, I won't have kind of too much to say about general massive gravity. So,
Which of these theories are supersymmetric extensions?
Supersymmetric extensions, okay, we are going to discuss about supersymmetric extensions tomorrow, but they do have, TMG has got an equal to one supersymmetric extension, which was worked out by Deser and Kay. And then there is an n equal to 2 supersymmetric extension as well, which has been worked out in more recent times.
It also is Townsend et al. Theory as well?
The one of Townsend, I'm not sure about that. I know TMG, but I don't know about.
What's the purpose of the particular coefficient 3/8 for R squared?
What is the coefficient 3/8?
I mean, is there something better about this theory than a general R squared theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions?
Well, that's why I asked whether it's supersymmetrizable. I mean, the coefficient.
I'm not sure why they would put out 3/8.
With the 3/8, you just get, if you linearize the equation, you just get one massive spin 2 field. And if you don't put the 3/8, you get something else. So you want to have only massive spin 2 extension.
I see.
Is that higher order derivative theorem?
Yeah, it's yeah,
so
sure.
You know, it's not like Gauss Bonnet where there's cancellation.
It's really higher order. It's not a boundary term. It's changing the equation of motion.
Right, and well, it changes also the particle content. So while TMG has got just gravitons of one helicity, their theory has got gravitons of two helicities. So it's a parity, the spectrum of the theory is a parity invariant, while TMG is not parity invariant. So the theory is different from when you send mu to minus mu.
Can't you change the coefficient by field redefinition?
No. Yeah, well, that was the number one question, right? You can't. You can't
because you are assuming absence of higher order terms or not.
So that's a very good point, and it's one we discussed in Vienna as well. So they claim, so their claim is they cannot remove this by a filter definition because you would have to make a non-local filter definition if you do the filter definition everywhere, and that kind of doesn't make sense. So that's their claim. That's the claim they do have in the paper. But I did ask exactly the same question. So and the physics is different. The physics is different. They claim particle spectrum is different than in TNG, so you cannot just remove it. More questions? Okay, so let me then come to the next point, which is introduce some basics that we will use in order to evaluate properties, check properties of this theory, say stability of the theory. So what I would like to do is to discuss charges, so charges and stability. Which were introduced, so the discussion on charges in gravity was introduced by Abbot, Deser, and Tekin. So, and the idea is to check precise charges for gravity, see whether energies are positive, so that we can explain stability. So if we are dealing with a conformal a general field theory, so which we know from so any field theory that is relevant for physics, what we know is that the energy can be written as an integral of a quantity that is positive definite, so some energy momentum tensor that is positive definite, which guarantees that the energy is positive and guarantees stability of the ground state because it's the state with the smallest energy. So the idea that Abbot, Deser, and Tekin had is they wanted to apply the same thing for gravity. So what they wanted to explain is that Minkowski space is stable, that the Sitter space is unstable. So they wanted to explain this way the cosmological constant problem, say the Sitter space is not stable, it decays, so in this way we can explain the cosmological constant problem. But sadly the idea didn't work because what they proved instead was stability. So let me show you how. So what the method is that Abbot, Deser used to construct conserved charges for gravity. So let me just take for simplicity for dimensional GR. So our goal is to construct conserved charges for gravity. Because what we would like to do is to check stability. So we start with the Einstein equation with a cosmological constant. And in order to define, we need to find the analog of the gravitational energy momentum tensor. In order to do so, what we would like to do is to write down our metric for, so we can consider either the Sitter, anti-de Sitter, or Minkowski. So what we would like to do is to write our metric as a background metric that satisfies Einstein's equation plus h mu. H mu is a deviation from the background metric that doesn't have to be small, but it has to vanish at infinity so that we do have a metric that is asymptotically ADS or the zero or whatever we want, so it doesn't have to be small. So what we can do is we can insert an expansion like this of the metric into our Einstein's equation. So what we see is what we will get is terms of order h to the zero, which are equal to zero because the background satisfies Einstein's equation. We get terms that are linear in h, and we get terms that are of order h squared plus higher. So these terms of order h squared and higher are the ones that give us the energy momentum tensor for the gravitational field. So let me write down this. Let me be here a little bit more precise. So let me write down Einstein's equation then in the following form, a linear term. So RL means the Ricci tensor, the linear part in H of the Ricci tensor. So we'll see later on the explicit form when I need it later on in 3D gravity. So this will give us the energy momentum tensor of the gravitational field. So what we can do with this energy momentum tensor, it has got some good properties, which allows us, number one, to define a charge, number two, that is conserved. So how can we do that? So number one, what we know is that the Bianchi identity, the background Bianchi identity, tells us that the covariant derivative of this expression here is equal to zero. So this one here, so the bar means it's the covariant derivative with respect to the background metric. So what it's telling us then is that, so going to this side here, so what it's telling us is that the background covariant derivative of the right-hand side is equal to zero. So in other words, let me write down here, the background covariant derivative of T mu is equal to zero. So we can use this T mu that I constructed here to construct conserved charges. Namely, we can contract this conserved charges with the Killing vectors of the background. So we do have Killing vectors of the background because the background has got symmetries, either we do have de Sitter or anti de Sitter. So what we know is that we do have Killing vectors that satisfy an equation like this. So if we take, if we contract, let me erase maybe over there. So if we contract our energy momentum tensor with those Killing vectors, what we get is a conserved charge. So let me show you why that is so. So so what we do have is a lambda mu, mu nu, zeta nu, so I'm contracting the energy momentum tensor with a Killing vector. So what we know is, so this, I'm claiming that this defines a conserved charge Q, because what we can do is apply our covariant derivative and what we know is that this object here is equal to zero, which is how I started, covariant derivative acting on the energy momentum tensor is equal to zero. What we can do is use the symmetry of T mu nu, so to write down this expression here as 1/2 lambda mu zeta nu. Anyway, you get the idea. So let me just erase here. So what we see is that the other part, the other contribution vanishes because the energy momentum tensor is symmetric. And if you check out how this expression looks like, it's just the ordinary derivative of a quantity, mu nu, zeta nu is equal to zero. So this quantity here defines a conserved charge. So it's a charge density, which means we can obtain a conserved charge by integrating this quantity over our volume, so our space. So let me, so conserved charge. Let me call this energy. So energy, when we insert, so so for a metric that falls fast enough at infinity, so we can take the zero component of this expression to define a conserved charge. If this vector here, the Killing vector that I wrote down, is a time-like Killing vector, then this conserved charge defines the energy. So we take this time-like, and we get a conserved charge describing the energy, which they call the Killing energy. So it turns out that this Killing energy, so that this expression can be written in precisely the same way as we know for Flatt-Minkowski space with a vanishing cosmological constant. So what we know, so one formula you might be familiar with is that the energy of the gravitational field, so for vanishing lambda, and if you use Cartesian coordinates, so what we know is that the energy of the gravitational field can be written in a form like this, as an integral over a surface at infinity. And a similar formula, so this is for vanishing cosmological constant, a similar formula can be derived for this expression here. If one takes into account that the energy momentum tensor of the gravitational field can be written in terms of a superpotential. So let me just sketch how this goes. Maybe not write down all the steps. So this integral, so it's two steps of calculation. So what you can see is that this integral can be written in a similar form as an integral over a surface integral at spatial infinity. So it's not kind of too relevant for the discussion, but let me write it down anyway. Of a superpotential, which is defined in terms of the magic H. So let me just write it down here. So here is called the superpotential. Not sure why it's called superpotential, it sounds so misleading. So it's called the superpotential, and which is defined in terms, so let me just write down some of the terms.
Is it the superpotential of X supergravity?
I don't think it's related, but maybe I'm misinformed. Maybe somebody else, it's not. It's not, I don't think so.
The term superpotential for this predates supersymmetry.
Oh, maybe that's the point why it's called superpotential.
Beyond the potential.
Uh-oh.
So that's how it comes. There's a term called the superpotential for electromagnetism that is the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's a sum of terms. Let me just write down one of the terms. The rest goes by permutation of indices. So where this H is just expressed in terms of the metric. Okay. So now we do have an expression for the energy, so just as a side remark, so the energy can be written as an integral over a surface at spatial infinity. Again, so if you take this expression here, you set the cosmological constant equal to zero, and use Cartesian coordinates, you recover the familiar formula that you know. So what's next? So what I've written down so far is... I didn't what? Oh. There are more terms here, which is why I didn't close it. Okay, so So, but it's all terms that look kind of in a similar manner. It's just permutation of indices, so I illustrated one of them. So what I've discussed so far is the full nonlinear theory, because I said, well, the energy momentum tensor involves contributions of order h square, and Higer. So, but if you actually would like to evaluate how the energy of a particular solution looks like, it's good to apply perturbation theory. So what we would like to do then is to set the metric that I have here, to expand the metric that I do have, this H, in a perturbation series. And it's usually fine to evaluate this H, so let me call this H tilde. So we would like to evaluate this in perturbation series, where this H tilde is equal to H mu times lambda plus lambda square J mu plus dot, where this lambda is a small parameter in which we would like to expand. So that's something we are going to use later on when we would like to evaluate particular energies of the graviton modes. Okay, so let me, so now that I've introduced the basics that I need, so let me show you how, let's come to the next point, which is, so we covered now stability of conserved charges, we covered the different models. So let's look a little bit more precisely on how TMG, what the particle content of TMG is, how the energies look like, and whether the theory is stable. So the action for TMG that I erased has an equation of motion, so it's gone already by now, the action, but so the equation of motion that we do have for TMG is an equation of motion that looks in this way, where G mu is the Einstein tensor, so it's the Einstein tensor with cosmological constant included. And C mu is the Cotton tensor. So it's called the Cotton tensor. So let me write down the explicit form of the Cotton tensor. So, because what you can see from the explicit form of the Cotton tensor is that any solution to Einstein's equation, namely that satisfy an equation like this, is a solution of TMG, but not because the Cotton tensor vanishes, but not the other way around. So what we know, is that one of the solutions of TMG, is ADS3. Which in global coordinates, so let's write down TMG in global coordinates so that I can set up my notation. So metric in global coordinates looks in the following form. Again, the L square is related to the cosmological constant. And I should probably have mentioned that the Cotton tensor is the three-dimensional analog of the Weyl tensor. So what we do have is, so a metric in ADS3 is a, so ADS3 metric is a solution to Einstein's equation, well, and to TMG. And it's a solution that does have a particular group of isometries, SO2, COPA2 in two dimensions. So it has a group of isometries, which is SO2, 2. which is isomorphic to what we call the left moving, so SL2R left cross SL2R right group of symmetries. And we can write down how the generators of this isometries look like. So what we know is that if I introduce, so it's the global algebra, so it's a global algebra in the bulk. Global SL2R algebra in the bulk is generated by L0, L plus minus 1. And the similar, so a similar algebra for the right moving sector, where let me just put a bar for the right moving sector. So we have an algebra for the left and the right moving sector. And we can write down how the explicit form of the generators of this symmetries look like. So when acting on scalars, what we know is that, so when acting on scalars, so later on when we use the explicit form of the generators when acting on the metric, we will write them in terms of Lie derivatives. But when acting on scalars, what we know is that L0, let me introduce coordinates, u is equal to tau plus phi, v is equal to tau minus phi. So what we know is that those Virasoro generators can be written in terms of our coordinates in this way here. So let me put. You can easily check is that this Virasoro generators satisfy the algebra, that the SL2R algebra, so it's easy to check that this satisfy zero, L plus minus one. And we can use, also easily check that the SL2R, the second Casimir of SL2R, is related to the Laplacian in this coordinates. Theta factor L. So, which is something that is going to be important later on. So what we know is that this is the global algebra that we do have in the bulk, and what Brannon and Noh showed is that this global algebra in the bulk gets enhanced to an infinite dimensional algebra that lives on the boundary. The central charges, so Brannon and Noh computed for us the central charges. They showed that the central charges of this theory look in the following way. So Brannon and Noh did their calculation. When they did their calculation, they didn't include, they did not include the gravitational Trans-Simons term. So they did have two central charges, one for the left and the right moving sector, that are equal, which is the theory that wouldn't consider it, which is why holomorphic factorization kind of is not so clear from this point of view. However, if you include a cosmological constant, which is what Strominger and collaborators did, so what you see is that the central charges get modified in an interesting way, in this way here. So what we see is that at a particular point, when this of the at a particular value of the coupling constant, when this mu times L is equal to 1, the right moving central charge is equal to 0. So from mu times L equal to 1, what we see is that the right moving central charge is equal to 0, while the left moving charge It's different from zero. So that's a first indication that the theory might be chiral in the sense that we only do have left-moving excitations, but no, did I do this in the wrong way? Yes, I did it in the wrong way. Well, let me just follow up so that I don't turn it in the other way around. So let me set this to the left. This is the right. So the theory does only have right-moving excitations, so it's the first conjecture that the theory may have these properties. However, later developments, so that was the reason why the theory was, from first principles, called chiral gravity. However, later developments indicated that the situation is not quite that trivial, that you need to be more precise in what type of boundary conditions you would like to use, and it's going to depend on the boundary conditions whether the theory is chiral or non-chiral, because these conditions are satisfied both so for log gravity and for chiral gravity. So let's see this in a little bit more detail in a moment. So what I would like to do is then to show you how the gravitons of this theory look like and what the energies of the gravitons contained in this theory are. So let's then come to the next point, which is evaluating the equations of motion to first order and perturbation theory, which will give us the information on how the graviton wave functions look like. Maybe I should erase over here. So what I would like to do is to evaluate, Einstein's equation, which I do have already on the board, but to first order in perturbation theory. So let me put a 1 here, which means I took my metric, I expanded it around the background, took all the terms that are linear in H. So let me just show you how some of the terms look like. Let me write down everything, because before one uses a particular gauge, the equations get pretty complicated, but they become very nice and simple when we use a particular gauge. So the way I wrote this equation, so before using a particular gauge, let's give you an example so that you see they get pretty lengthy and complicated. So where this R, we knew that I introduced here the first order Ricci tensor. So yes, so as you see, it's something first order in derivatives of H mu, and then there are more terms along this line. So let me not write down the full expression. So what you can see is everything, so all the terms, including this one, maybe I should write down the definition of this one. So you see, so all the terms are linear, so all contributions are linear in H. Writing them out, so it gets pretty lengthy, but it turns out that most of the terms vanish if you choose a particular gauge. And Strominger and collaborators showed that one very convenient gauge is the divergence-free, traceless divergence-free gauge. This is a convenient gauge choice in which the lengthy expressions that I didn't all write down there become very simple. And it turns out that the equation of motion for the graviton can be written in terms of the SL2R Laplacian. So let me write down this one, because that one is a very nice one. So the SL2R, so the SL2R Casimir, which is this Laplacian that I wrote down, acts on the metric. in this way here. And what this means is that we can use the SL2R algebra to classify the solutions, the set of solutions that we get from the equation of motion. So use the SL2R algebra.
Melanie?
Yep.
Why aren't you getting third order field equations?
Why am I not getting third order? Oh, thank you. I forgot a derivative. Good. All right. So I forgot to write another derivative here. Well, that should make more sense. Good. Thank you. So, so now you can use the SL2R algebra to classify the solutions. Namely, we can we know that at zero, when acting on H mu, so primary fields can be obtained when we act with at zero on H, so our eigenstates, which same thing if you write down, so if you work in the right moving algebra, so let me go down this way here, what we know is that L1 and L1 is an annihilation operator, same thing for L1 bar. And L-1 will act as a raising operator. So we can construct descendants. And what we can then do is to solve these equations here to obtain the explicit form of our gravitational field. So let me show you what comes out of this calculation. Yeah.
So this means that you are only solving for highest weight solutions, right?
Yes.
But there are other solutions too, so is there an argument that you could recover arbitrary solution from highest weight solution, or you're just focused on particular solutions?
So what else is we do have the gravitons, which are the primary states of the theory. And then there are descendants of these fields, which are black hole states. So
yeah, but
the question is, do you know that the only modes in the theory are primary modes and their descendants?
What else does a conformal field theory have?
You could have things that don't involve higher weight. You could have representations that don't have highest weight states.
Two-sided.
That don't have highest weight states.
Here we are not even talking about conformal field theory, we're just doing this.
It becomes a conformal field theory when you talk about the dual on the boundary, sure. Yeah.
But here just...
It's a representation of the SL2R algebra. Yeah. It's not clear, I don't know.
It should follow from positivity of energy, but I don't see it right away like this.
From positivity.
Some positive? Oh, well, then.
Okay, so let's see how the energy of this thing.
It does appear to work. I mean, right, Deser and friends, when they originally wrote down TMG, did a different analysis that sort of counted the degrees of freedom, and at least at the level of counting linear solutions, this gives the right answer.
Okay, so let's leave it at that. So what we know is that solving. So if we use the I wrote down a moment ago how the zero operators, L0 and L0 bar operators look like. So when acting on scalars, is going to come up handy. So what we can see is that solutions to this equation or to this equation can be written as harmonic functions on ADS3. So let me show you what we can see already from such a solution. So where this M that I'm writing here is symmetric, depends on the rho. And what we can see easily of this E that I wrote down here, annotation is that this is H plus H bar, this S is H minus H bar, And what you can easily see is that if we act with a zero on this front part here, which is what depends on tau and phi, what we see is that we can solve, satisfy this equation, so the L0 and the L0 bar equation. And what we can do is to use the other constraint, the L1 and the L1 bar constraint, to determine this this symmetric tensor that I wrote down there. So L1 acting on H mu, let me write it down in the following way. L1 plus minus L1 bar acting on H mu equal to 0 will give us this M. And let me tell you how the solution looks like. Oh, by the way, and I should have mentioned this, so the moment, I think I mentioned it a moment ago, so when you apply this L to a two-index object, use the Lie derivatives, and the rest is straightforward. So what you see is that solutions to this equation, to the L1 constraint, are either right or left moving, so depending whether the spin that I wrote down there is equal to plus minus 2, and take the following form. So the energy at this point, this h plus h bar, is not determined at this point, but the spin s is determined. And then, well, we do have our 3 by 3 matrix, so let me write it out because it's so simple. So S again is plus minus 2, depending whether we are dealing with right or left movers. The A that I'm introducing here, I'm going to define in a second. So the A that I introduced is given in terms of 4 in the following way. Okay. So what you see is, so everything in this expression for the left and right moving gravitons is fixed. So the spin is determined, this A is defined, except for the E, which is still not determined at this point. But we can, again, insert this expression here back into our equation of motion, and which will determine for us the value of E. So it's determined from the equation of motion. And what comes out at the end of the day is that the theory contains, the spectrum of the theory contains the following states. So there are states that are left moving states, which I called HR a moment ago. Do have H is equal to 0, H2, H bar equal to 0. Then there are left moving states, left and right moving states. There are two states, so this corresponds to massless representations. And then, so these are boundary states. But then there is the third state, so which is the one. So these are the states that you already see in ordinary Einstein gravity. But there is one more state, which is the one that only appears if you add the gravitational transimmons term, which is the massive mode, the one that propagates in the bulk. Whose weights are this ones. Yeah.
So the equation you're solving for H involves just these Virasoro this SL2R operators.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those didn't depend on mu.
Those did not.
Just the symmetries of your background ADS.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Fine.
So the solution shouldn't depend on mu.
Yes, it does, because I need to insert back into this equation of motion to determine the E.
So that's something.
But that's a very good point. So, which is why, to determine this E, I need to insert back, which is why this thing here then comes out depending on me.
Could you remind me how E is determined then?
E is H plus H bar. And the H bar are the ones that I'm writing in here. So H bar, which fixes the E.
And L is positive? L is goes from 1 to infinity?
L goes L? Which L?
Mu L, the
U L.
Okay, I should have said one thing a moment ago that I kind of now need is the following. We did have central charges which were 3L divided by 2G, 1 minus 1 divided by mu L, and the right central charge goes with a plus sign. So what we see is that if we would like to have a theory that is unitary, central charge is positive. So what we need is that the absolute value of mu times L has to be bigger than 1. And the theory with mu going to minus mu, they are related by parity. So you can restrict to mu times L, absolute value of mu times L has to be bigger than 1.
See, that mu goes to minus mu looks a bit funny in that expression because it's not. And if mu L is plus 1, I get 2, 0. But if mu L is minus 1, I get 1.
Yes. So, but the only thing that you do is you exchange left and right numbers. The only thing that you do when you send mu to minus mu is you exchange left and right numbers. So it's a matter of convention.
Okay.
So you choose 1 mu L given.
Hmm?
It's given, so which you can choose mu L to be positive, then energy is positive. So I can't understand why you're dealing with the lowest feature representation.
I still didn't talk about energy. Wait. So if you give me a second, so I would like to evaluate the energy. So I didn't tell you what the energy of this particular, so of this massive mode is. So I need to, so give me just a second. Okay, so I think I'm doing fine with time. So what we see from here is that a particular value when mu times L is equal to 1, what I see from these weights is that the massive mode becomes equal to, so the conformal weights of the massive mode become equal to the left moving modes. So, and the wave functions which depend on these modes are then also identical. So Hm is equal to H left at the chiral point, mu L is equal to 1. So two solutions to the differential equation degenerate, which will have kind of some consequences in a moment. So let me tell you what the energy of the states are, which is my next point. So evaluate now Einstein's equation to second order perturbation theory, which will allow us to obtain the energy momentum tensor for the gravitational field, and from there deduce the energies. So if we go with Einstein's equation, so which comes in handy here, to next order, so what we know is that, so let me again remind you, so G menu so, and we insert this into our equation there, so what we get is the following. So we get the Einstein tensor linear in J, so I'm looking for terms of order lambda square. So what we get is an Einstein tensor, which is linear in J, same functional form as I had before, plus 1 over mu, the Cotton tensor, again, linear in J. So that's the part we are not so much interested in, but what we then can get from here is our energy momentum tensor of the gravitational field, which comes from the Einstein tensor, but now the quadratic part in H, minus 1 divided by mu. So this gives us the energy momentum tensor of the gravitational field very interested in. And we can, of course, directly evaluate, so see how those expressions look like. So let me just give you one example instead of writing here everything out. From where we can then easily compute the energies and check for stability of the ADS3 solution. So maybe I should just write that. So this Gemini 2 that I wrote down here. So what we know is that, say, let me tell you what maybe this Gemini 2 is. So it contains terms that are quadratic in H. Plus more terms, and so on and so forth. So everything is now quadratic in H. And what we can do is, so now that we do have the energy momentum tensor of the gravitational field, well, we contract it with the time-like Killing vector, and it gives us the energies. So let me write down, so this determines for us. So from here we get the energies. And so let me tell you what comes out of this formula. What we know is that the energy of the massive mode, so what I called HM, takes the following form. Let me not write down the constant, maybe. So it depends on the wave function of the massive mode and its time derivative. Then there is, maybe I should write down this in the following way. So the right moving mode differs by the left moving mode just by a sign. Okay, so what we see, so these are the energies of all the modes in the theory, the massive mode, left and right moving mode. So you can insert the wave functions into this integrals here and check that the integrals here are negative. So all integrals here are negative by explicit insertion of the wave functions that I wrote down a moment ago. So and what you can check is then the sign of the energy. So what we see, number one, is that if this thing here is negative, what we see is that for mu L times bigger than 1, the energy of the massive graviton is negative. Oops, this thing is too small. So what we see is that the energy of the massive graviton is less than 0 for mu times L bigger than 1. We also see that for mu times L equal to 1, it vanishes. So EM is equal to 0 at the chiral point, mu times L equal to 1. What we also see is that the energy of the left moving mode is always positive. It's always positive because the integral is again negative. So what we know is that EL is always positive for mu L bigger than 1, and it vanishes at the chiral point, while the energy of the massive mode is always positive. So what we see is something.
Right.
What? Oh, sorry. Yeah. Of the right. Moving mode is always positive. So what we see is that the way Sturm and Jahn collaborators solved the problem with the massive graviton having negative energy is very interesting, because at the chiral point, this negative energy vanishes, which is exactly the point where the theory becomes chiral. All left moving charges of the theory are equal to zero. Only right movers appear in the theory. What you see is that at the chiral point, energies of massive mode and left moving modes are equal to zero. So the energy that was previously negative vanishes, which means only at the chiral point do we have chances that TMG is a stable theory. For neural different than one, the theory is unstable because it contains mode with negative energy. So the $1 million question, probably Stefan is going to say more about this, is what does it decay into if the theory is unstable? So
why can't mu L be less than one?
Mu L be less than one. Oh, because I said I wanted to have an absolute value that is bigger than one because of unitarity. So.
I'm not sure it's any less unitary from UL less than one than from UL greater than.
But they are related by parity then, right?
They're what?
So if you look at the central charges, so if you look at the expression for the central charges, they are just your extension left and right movers if you make them UL negative.
Yeah, but UL less than one.
No, she means to say one of the central charges would be negative, and then the theory would.
Yeah, so
it's already non-unitary because it goes from the theory from UL greater than one.
So the physical Hilbert space is what should be in the representation of the Virchow algebra, and if the central charge is negative, the physical Hilbert space is presumably unitary.
So what I'm saying is that absolute value. So let's see whether we can agree on this one. Absolute value of mu times L has to be bigger than one. From unitary, right?
So if you want to have a CFT, which is unitary,
uh-huh,
and has highest weight representations,
yes,
then the central charges have to be positive or not.
Okay, that's what I want to have. Okay. So what is what you would like to have?
Well, anyway, Don, coming back to your point, energy is positive at that point. So.
At which point? So
at the chiral point, you see, are positive, so that the assumption they made about calculating
the
right zero.
The chiral point is a special case.
Okay.
But UL greater than one, mm-hmm, as will be explicit in one of the talks tomorrow, mm-hmm, it's a consequence of what you have written on the board, mm-hmm, that there is, in fact, a ghost in the theory from UL greater than one.
Good.
And therefore, in some uses of the language, the theory is already non-unitary from UL greater than 1, so it's not clear to me that UL less than 1 is that much worse. That
good.
Would be common.
Tomas is going to explain how to kick out the ghosts tomorrow. Okay, so let me then, if there are no further questions, come to my last point, which is... have 5 more minutes for, yes.
Are you going to talk also about on this discussion about this next combo that comes at the chiral point?
The what?
When mu L is exactly equal to 1 at the beginning.
Yes.
And you don't take the limits of this solution from two. Well, if you try to solve the mu L's equation at the chiral point.
Yes.
And not in place of looking at the solution in some other point of the chiral point, trying to take the limit and see.
Are you talking about low gravity? I'm
yes.
Taking the limit. So that's what I'm going to do right now. So that's the last thing that I wanted to discuss, which is how the log mode appears. So which is the one subtlety I was mentioning. If you look at a differential equation, and there are two solutions, so let me just erase it first. So Grumiller and Johansson realized, so let me just write down their names, so I'll put them on the... So Grumiller and Johansson Yes. Yes.
Probably you already know this, but what happens if mu L is smaller than minus 1?
Well, mu, so it's again parity. So you're, if you send mu L to less than, mu times L less than minus 1, so what you're doing is changing parity. Mu goes to minus mu exchanges left and right numbers.
Then it seems that EM is positive and that the central charges are positive.
Then it seems that. But you need to have, there's one thing you need to take into account. The mods have to be normalizable. So you cannot choose there. So you have to write down the sign conventions in such a way that it's normalizable. If you change mu to minus mu, you have to change, you have to continue changing signs so that you pick up the normalizable mod. So anyway, promise it works. So just work out the logic through the signs. So if you start changing parity, take into account that the normalizable mode then will change again sign somewhere. So
your statement is that the equations in the board are really only true for mu L positive.
Right. Well, that's the convention. In the moment when I start with central charge, I agree on one convention and I stick to that one. So there is one subtlety when we. As I mentioned here, at the chiral point, the left moving modes and the massive mode degenerate. So there is a subtlety with that argument, namely there is a new mode, so the modes don't just disappear. There is one additional solution to the theory, which is the so-called log mode. So you can construct, so the log mode is a new solution that always shows up when in a differential equation we do have two solutions that degenerate. So let me call this then the Müller-Johansson mod, which you can easily check, just takes the following form. So you can easily check that this is an additional solution at the chiral point to the equations of motion at the chiral point, which describes the so-called log mod. Log mod because it does have properties that are very reminiscent of a log conformal field theory. So it takes, I should have probably defined what my y is here. So it's minus I times tau minus log. Of course, wrong. So, and you can easily check that if you use this solution here, you work at the chiral point, you can easily check that it's an additional solution to the equations of motion. An additional solution that has got some very peculiar properties, namely, number one, it has got energy that is finite, but the energy of the mode is negative, which Grumuller and Johansson wanted to use then to argue, okay, chiral gravity is not stable. So, however, and the mode cannot be gauged away, which is probably something I should have said earlier, we agreed that the left-moving sector of the theory is trivial, so which means the massive mode and the left-moving mode can be gauged away when we are at the chiral point. However, in this case, the log mode cannot be gauged away, so it cannot be gauged away. There is one thing that is different from the modes that I previously had, namely the mode has different boundary conditions. So in the coordinates that I wrote down, which is the way how we can exclude this mode from chiral gravity, it's a mode that does have different boundary conditions. So let me show you how. It's a mode that blows up at special infinity. So if you wrote down, maybe I should briefly mention this. So let me again use the coordinates that I. And let me write down how the B behavior at infinity of different metric components. Let me write down just the maybe some of the relevant ones. So in for Brownian, so what is called Brownian boundary conditions. So what my metric components at special infinity do is they are either order one or they fall off sufficiently fast at infinity. So it's a behavior like this. So let me not write down all the components, and let me just, so this is so what is called Brownian boundary conditions. So the one that is relevant and that is the difference between what is Brownian boundary conditions, which is this, so we have other entries, so let me not write down all the entries here. So, but for Brownian boundary conditions, this metric component at infinity is of order one, while for the what is called relaxed boundary conditions, which are the boundary conditions for the log mod, this blows up and it's a term of order rho. So that the mod satisfies different boundary conditions, and if you define, if you agree that we would like to define our theory by the action of our theory and boundary conditions, then we do have two different theories. One is chiral gravity, which doesn't include the log mod because it has got just different boundary conditions, and log gravity. So the other theory is with this, with a new set of relaxed boundary conditions, it's called log gravity. It has got chiral gravity as a subsector. So, understanding. So, understanding.
The normalizability of that mode.
What happens to normalizability of that mode? Normalizability. What happens to normalizability? Yeah, you know the norm.
It's normalizable.
It is, even though it blows up like that. It's normalized.
Yeah, log isn't a problem.
It's gonna. So now the talk tomorrow is gonna be about norms. So Tomas and Don computed the norms. So they will tell us about the norms tomorrow. So
So a brief comment about it. So I agree that this mode can be gauged away, but you seem to imply that the left mode can be gauged away in the chiral point.
Yes.
I think I disagree with that because we call a gauge mode a null directional to the symplectic structure. Then you have mixed products between psi L and psi nu.
Tomas will clarify this tomorrow.
It's not
okay.
Gauge mode.
Okay, so he will clarify that part tomorrow. Okay, so, but in principle, if you would like to have a, so that's at least how the current status is. I'm not sure whether your status is going to change tomorrow, but the current status is left movers and massive modes can be gauged away, which is why the theory is carrying. We only have the right moving modes. So, okay, Brownian no boundary. With Brownian no boundary conditions, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Otherwise, the theory is not carrying. Right. Yeah, we own that one. Okay, so to conclude, so let me just mention some. Oh, you were asking.
So what do you mean by gauged away? You mean gauged away a mode that can be written as the lead derivative for some form of
the background metric?
This is not all things are gauged.
Then you can argue whether the diffeomorphism is trivial or not. But I would say that.
Yeah. Right. It's a diffeo, I agree. It's a diffeo, but it's not gauge.
So this is the difference between pure gauge and propagating. It's more like that distinction.
Yeah, it's a matter of one.
So what is your...
My approach to call something a gauge is a null direction of the symplectic structure. So
the charges are zero.
Even the charges are zero as well. As a consequence.
Okay, so let me then continue what I want to say next. So the conclusion is, there are many interesting open questions in this area. It's one of the areas where we hope to understand both sides of ADS-CFT because the three-dimensional part, well, is ADS-3. It's gravity in three-dimensional space-time. The two-dimensional part, it's a two-dimensional conformal field theory, which we hope to understand, though it turns out that extremal conformal field theories, which are dual to this, are really hard to understand, really hard to construct. Maybe we get some insights from the gravity side. So if you want to construct those for large central charge, people are having all sorts of trouble. So, but renormalizability connections to string theory are open questions, so it's not clear whether this is a theory that does come from string theory. Maybe it's a truncation, or maybe it's a decoupling limit from string theory, so nobody ever talked about this, so it's something open question. It's not, well, 100% clear whether the theory is renormalizable or not. I think there has been a paper just recently talking about renormalizability of TNG. There was an old paper by Deser. But it's something that kind of, if the connection to string theory is not clear, it's something that needs to be addressed. So there are many interesting open questions, and I would like to pass the ball to my younger colleagues. Thank you. I was going to give 2:30 minutes.